This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
Bobby, did you say flurries? I think you did.
Did I?
I did.
Yeah, you're correct. Yeah. I thought, oh my God, how could I say that? But you are right.
Yeah.
Chance of flurries
right.
Or showers.
It's not over till it's
remember,
over.
Remember, messenger only, okay?
Exactly.
Don't make it up. Trust me.
Libby is on vacation this week, so happy to be here with you today. Well, as a woman, do you have a gender preference as to whether your doctor is male or female? And what about you guys? Does it matter to you whether you are treated by a woman or a male physician? Let's get the phones ringing today, 416-360-0740 or toll-free 1-866-744-740. I asked the question because of a new U.S. study published Monday in the Annals of Internal Medicine, which concludes hospitalized women are less likely to die or be readmitted to hospital if they are treated by women doctors. Now, the difference appears minimal. In the study of people 65 and older, 8.15% of women treated by female physicians died within 30 days, compared with 8.38% of women treated by male physicians. Researchers say erasing the gap could save 5,000 women's lives each year.
Now, time for The Medical Record.
Our medical record panelists are Dr. Nadia Alam, family doctor and anesthetist in Georgetown, Ontario, and past president of the Ontario Medical Association. Dr. Fahad Razak, Canada Research Chair in Data-Informed Healthcare Improvement at the University of Toronto. And Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist at Princess Margaret Cancer Centre. Welcome to you all.
Thanks, Libby.
Great to be with you.
Dr. Alam, and it's Jane here. I understand this new research is part of a growing field of study examining why women and minorities tend to receive worse medical care than men and white patients. What are your thoughts on this? Is this an American thing? Is it a cross-cultural, cross-country thing?
I think it's a North American thing. North America predominantly has been made up of Caucasian population, so white people essentially that are generally of the Christian faith. So a lot of that has dominated the culture for a number of years. Now, North America is becoming more diverse, more multicultural as more people immigrate, as people stay here and raise families and start exploring other cultures. So a lot of those old ideas that used to be around different cultures, different ethnicities, different genders are changing. The problem is medicine continues to have a certain amount of bias built into it, not because healthcare workers are bad people. We have unconscious biases that inform what we do because we are people. We've grown up in a particular culture, climate, that sort of thing. And those unconscious biases can affect how we interact with other people, particularly in something like healthcare or medicine. So we do see that.
So, Dr. Alam, the women that you treat are your patients. Do you have, on occasion, do women say to you, I prefer having you as my doctor because I like having a woman doctor more so than a male doctor, and maybe provides you with some reasoning around that?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of the women who've come to my practice, and actually some of the men who've come to my practice, come to me and say, you take my symptoms more seriously. You don't just dismiss them as anxiety or as being tired or as being a mom or as being a dad or working too much, being too stressed out. You actually take these symptoms seriously. And I think when you look at studies, a lot of the symptoms, and I'm going to focus on perimenopause as an example because I'm going through perimenopause.
Right. Yes, been there, done that.
So menopause is this huge transition in a woman's life. And a lot of stuff gets missed leading up to that time, that final transition when your periods stop. And you head into the postmenopausal stage. There are a lot of symptoms that are part and parcel of perimenopause, and there are a lot of symptoms that are not. However, they all overlap. And both sides can be treated, and often aren't, because they're just dismissed as, oh, you're tired, you're a mom, you're busy taking care of your parents, you're busy working, and that's just the way it is. So I think having a female doctor actually helps women, particularly, be able to explain things that and be taken in a different way than perhaps when they're speaking to a male physician, right? And we know women present with illness differently than men. The symptoms they have of heart attack are not the same as the symptoms that men have with heart attacks.
Okay, let's go to our male doctors on the panel. Dr. Razak, how do you feel about this information that's come out of this U.S. study suggesting that some women are better off having a woman doctor than a male doctor?
I found this study to be really interesting, and it actually builds on extensive prior research, including research actually by our research group here in Ontario. So we did a study that was published 2 years ago where we looked at 200,000 patient encounters in hospital here in Ontario, and we showed that patients treated on average by women physicians had a 10% lower risk of dying in hospital than patients treated by their male colleagues. And we explored further why that occurred. And we found that, for example, female physicians were more likely to order tests on their patients, and they kept their patients longer in hospital. And this built on extensive prior research that had shown that female physicians on average were found to be much more patient-centered in their clinical encounters, that they spent a longer period of time communicating on average with their patients. They showed more empathy and concern for their patients' health issues. And they were more likely to, for example, keep up to date with research literature, consult informally with their specialist colleagues, or spend more time reading the patient chart. And so we saw this effect layer on to a broader behavioral series of studies that show that female physicians really do approach these medical encounters with their patients with some important systematic differences. And I would say this as a male colleague, things that we can learn and model. So, you know, if you just say on average female physicians are doing better, that doesn't really give you the strategies as a male physician to say why are they doing better. But this other literature tells you things: more time with their patients, more time keeping up to date with the literature. And I would just say that the really important paired piece of evidence with all of this is that, of course, on average, women physicians get paid less on an hourly basis than male physicians, like many other fields. So you have clear evidence that they're doing better in many ways. There's also the evidence that they get paid less for their work. So I would say a lot that we could improve in this.
So let's go over to Dr. Malcolm Moore. When you hear this study, when you read about other similar studies, from your male perspective, do you see why the results are this way? Are you able to learn as a man what your female colleagues are doing that maybe you're not doing, or is that too much of a broad stroke?
Okay, so interesting question. Well, first of all, for the record, I have a female family doctor. I think she's terrific, and I'm quite happy talking to her about my prostate, even though she doesn't have one. And I think when you want a doctor, what you want is availability, affability, and ability. And you can find that in a good female physician, a good male physician. The other thing I think we need to acknowledge that is very important is that 25 years ago, only 20 to 25% of the people entering medical school were women. In 2024, more than half the graduating classes from the medical schools in Canada are women. And I think that's been an important change. I think it's a very good thing. And I think it's quite possible, it is possible that women physicians as a group have some superior qualities to men. I think, honestly, it's always dangerous to kind of classify people by sex or race or whatever. and say this group is better than this group. But I think this study doesn't show us anything. This is not a good study. I looked at it in preparation for this. It's a very small difference.
Mm-hmm.
And this study was, it's described as a sprawling study, which is not normally a scientific study, but it looked at a subset of patients. And I don't know, it, for any of our listeners who've been in the hospital, when you're in the hospital, you're not looked after by one doctor. You're looked after by, you see many different doctors. And so if you talk to someone who's been in the hospital and you ask them, who was your doctor? They will see different people on the weekend. They'll see different people who are in the wards. They'll see different specialists. So to say that someone who is in the hospital is cared for by one physician, I think is overly simplistic. So I don't think it's a particularly good study. I think it kind of catches your attention because it shows this difference in favor of female physicians over male physicians, but it's a very small difference. But I think what we do need to do is celebrate the fact that we have many more women physicians graduating now than we used to.
Right. From a perspective of someone who is almost 60, 58, turning 59, when I was growing up and first was going to see a family doctor without my mother in attendance, it was always a man. There was one particularly uncomfortable moment I had as a 13, 14-year-old girl with a male family physician. And from that point on, it colored how I felt about my family doctor and have only had women doctors ever since then. So I'm wondering, Dr. Alam, if from the patient's perspective, it is a generational feeling of being more comfortable with a woman than with a man.
I think it's partly like what's been said. You do want a doctor you can connect to. I've got patients who've had male doctors in the past. They'll come to me in their 50s and 60s because their previous physician, family doc, has retired. And they had great relationships with them. But I do find that there is a tendency for female physicians and for some younger men to prefer female physicians. There is this perception of being heard in a different way, being attended to in a different way, being cared for in a different way. And some of it, like Dr. Razak said, is borne out by research and evidence. That said, as we continue to define and redefine gender and gender roles, it becomes really important to look at, well, why did this study suggest this? Why did previous studies suggest a difference? What are the lessons that we can, much like the other docs have said, right? What are the lessons that we can take away so that we create another generation of doctors who are just better, right? Better mm-hmm. and better and better. We want better care all the time. We want care that progresses the way our population does.
And Dr. Razak, as time goes on and the stats were pointed out just a few minutes ago that a very small percentage of doctors entering the field 25 years ago versus now were women. So you all as medical professionals are sharing information, sharing tactics, strategies, guidance. And so it would seem that eventually the perspective or the way in which a doctor treats a patient would not be gender related, but would be profession related as a result of culminated experiences.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, I think that I am the person on this panel who is the most recent graduate into the medical profession. And I would suspect that if you looked at the kind of training that I had versus what was in place, let's say 20 years ago, that we did have more of a formal education around the importance of some of these things, which the research literature has shown is maybe more intuitive to the way that women physicians are approaching patients. Again, being able to empathically hear the concerns of your patients, spending more time with them, doing that informal process of consultation. I think the important finding here, again, and as Malcolm said, and our study showed a relatively small difference, this U.S. study, a prior U.S. study 5 years ago, the differences are relatively small. To me, the most important thing is trying to learn from the strategies that are being used and why those are effective and trying to emulate that. Spending more time with your patients is not a gender issue, of course. Mm-hmm. It's something you can learn to do. And that's what's most important here.
Right. Okay. We will switch topics now. And just a reminder for you, our Zoomer radio listeners, if something is piquing your attention, if you would like to weigh in, the phone lines are always open on Fight Back. 416-360-0740-1-866-744-740. Honestly, I thought we would get some calls on gender preferences for doctors, but perhaps you've enjoyed the conversation more than offering your thoughts. Let's move to the front page story in the Globe and Mail. Medical schools raise alarm over declining interest in family medicine. It is an ongoing theme. The backdrop to this story today, senior representatives at four Ontario medical schools told a news conference this week that significant reforms, including raising pay, reducing administrative burdens, are necessary to persuade physicians of tomorrow to choose family medicine over higher paid specialties. So, Dr. Alleman, we've heard you talk about this from a personal perspective. How do we get there?
This is the first step. I mean, this is extraordinary that medical schools, our educational, our academic institutions are speaking up and speaking to the experiences that frontline family docs like myself face every single day of our professional lives, and actually even during our off hours, right? This isn't just about on hour work, this is about off hour work. My hope is that as more people speak up, the people who can make the change and are willing to invest in the change start listening more and more and more. We do have a terrible crisis. I have to say, Jane, my jaw dropped when I saw the statistic that very soon one in four Ontarians is not going to have a family doctor.
Right.
And family doctors, like other allied health providers in healthcare, are key to the system. You can't just replace one with the other. You can't replace a nurse with a family doctor. You can't replace a family doctor with a nurse. You have to have everybody working together, which means you have to have enough people on the ground. And the changes in the choices that medical students are making these days, I mean, for one, they're reflective of the reality of how difficult it's become to not only run a family practice as a small business, but also just work as a family doctor when you're inundated with the cost and burden of running an electronic medical record system, the cost of not just running a business, but keeping up with all of the administrative tasks of running a business, like human resources, hiring and firing people, as well as trying to keep up with the admin burden of managing reports, right? Managing all of the consultations and investigations that come in that you've generated for your patients, as well as what patients have needed and asked to be generated, as well as what's been generated by other specialists, and trying to coordinate it all into a whole. I think there is so much room for innovation. We talk about artificial intelligence. We talk about creating a more digital, friendly healthcare environment. And yet healthcare as a sector is one of the most conservative environments. In Canada, we've got to start taking some risks and trying out different ways of delivering medicine. Otherwise, we're not going to have family doctors left. And I don't want to be part of a dying breed.
Right. Dr. Moore, can you pick up on that thought? What needs to be done now so that students will choose family medicine as their career of choice?
You know, I found this this article incredibly cynical, to be honest with you. Like, I think the medical schools played a significant role in this crisis. And so for them to now say we need to have urgent reforms is a bit like somebody who smokes in bed and burns their house down and complains that the fire department needs to respond more quickly. I mean, a lot of this is driven by who was selected to go into medical school. Who does that? That's the medical schools. People's choice of specialty is driven by their experience during medical schools. The medical school curriculum is controlled by the medical schools and by the training programs afterwards, which are also run by the medical schools. So I think the medical schools are not the only culprit in this, but what they have done, and they've been very slow to change, has been an important component of this crisis. I think if what society needs is more family doctors, we need to create more
training physicians and family physicians. And we also need to create some level of competition for those positions so that they will be filled. And, you know, medicine is a very interesting specialty. Like, only 5% of people who apply for medical school actually get in. But once you get into medical school, then basically 100% of the class who starts in year one will graduate and will get a residency position. And I think, you know, this is a personal view, but I think if we graduated 2,500 medical students a year and there were 2,300 training spots with an increase in the number of family practice spots, if you put in some level of competition into the system, all of those spots are going to be filled, and you'll be able to grow the population of family doctors, which is very clear what we need at the present time.
Well, that sounds good. I will get to the phones here in a moment. Thank you for hanging on. 416-360-0740. Dr. Razak, your thoughts on what needs to be done to attract more people to family medicine?
I mean, where I think this article got it right is that one of the most damning statistics they reported in this article was that this year in the first round of the residency match, this is how medical students end up matching into a specialty profession, 100 roughly of the 550 family medicine spots in Ontario went unfilled. That is a shockingly high number. Now, how high is that number? Let's put it in comparison. So 100 spots went unfilled. Back in 2020, so only 4 years ago, that was only 30 spots that went unfilled. To me, that reflects the fact that the condition on the ground for family doctors has changed in such a substantial way that there is now, in many ways, a disincentive for these very smart, very keen medical students to go into this profession. And the two areas that these medical groups highlight, and I think you've heard this from this panel on prior in prior weeks, is that the support from a family for a family physician has to include comprehensive support, so team-based care. And the second is that the remuneration has to increase so it matches some of the higher earning specialties. And look, I'm not someone who thinks that people shouldn't follow their calling. If you want to be an eye doctor, if you want to be a dermatologist, these are wonderful professions, but if we have a severe shortage in society of family doctors, which are fundamentally the bedrock of the system, you have to make the financial and economic conditions for these physicians to be stronger so that more people want to go into it. I think there is a very strong economic argument to say that we have to narrow the difference between the way that these medical professions are paid in order to also incentivize people to go into it, along with the working conditions on the ground, team-based care, and other things that we've talked about. So there are multiple strategies, but just increasing the number of medical student spots is not going to work if they are not selecting family medicine as a profession to go into. And that's clearly what the residency match rates are showing.
Right. Makes sense. Let's go to Mary in Simcoe. Mary, what would you like to add to our medical record panel discussion?
Yes. What I'm feeling, and a lot of my friends and daughters are feeling the same way, is that it's not that we prefer a woman doctor, but we feel that male doctors don't take us as seriously as we think they should. For instance, they hesitate to refer you to a gynecologist, and that is worrisome.
Okay, thank you, Mary. Let's hear what Dr. Moore has to say about that. What should you do as a patient if you feel very strongly that, say, you do want to be referred to a specialist? A lot of women, especially women of a certain generation, I remember my mom fell culprit to this, they hesitated to question a male doctor when they were being consulted, when they were having their consultation.
You know, I understand what Mary's saying, and what struck me as she was talking is that it would be great if the system that we're paying for allowed people to have more choices. And I think the challenge at the moment is that if you're one of those Ontarians who's lucky enough to have a family doctor, then you're happy to have one. But in terms of having a choice of family physicians, that is a choice between a woman or a man, someone older versus someone younger,
those choices in the current system really don't exist because it's so hard for people to get access. So I think if a woman feels more comfortable with a woman doctor, then they should have a woman doctor. But the problem, as we keep coming back to, is that access to any family physician, male or female, is a challenge.
Yeah. I want to squeeze in one more topic before I say goodbye. The time always goes by too quickly. Dr. Razak, you brought this to our attention. A study published in the New England Journal of Medicine points to how microplastics and nanoplastics pose a potential risk for cardiovascular disease. And this is a timely discussion as we have representatives from 176 countries in Ottawa this week negotiating an international treaty on plastic pollution. Tell us about these microplastics and nanoplastics, which we are ingesting without realizing.
An incredibly important problem. And honestly, it's just so daunting when you look at the statistics. So microplastics are anything smaller than 5 millimeters. Nanoplastics are even smaller. And they are everywhere in our environment. They have been found now in fresh snowfall in Antarctica. They're in the deepest parts of the ocean, in the Marianas Trench. They're in human blood. They're in human breast milk. They're in urine. They're in the placenta. They're found in almost every organ in our body at this point. And this study showed in a very dramatic fashion the implications for disease and health as these microplastics enter the system and enter our bodies. They looked at roughly 250 patients and found that 150 of them, so two-thirds of the patients, already had microplastic deposits within the plaques within their arteries. Plaques are naturally forming fatty deposits within our arteries that have an important role in strokes and heart attacks. They then followed these patients over a three-year period, and they found that those who had these microplastics, these nanoplastics within their plaques, had a five-fold greater risk of having a cardiovascular event like a heart attack or a stroke within the next 3 years. To put that in context, that would be more powerful than some of the most important risk factors we talk about for cardiovascular disease, things like blood pressure or cholesterol. Just the fact that these deposits existed within the arteries was more powerful in explaining who ended up getting sick. The reason why this global meeting and symposium that's being held in Canada this week is really important is that really we have very few technologies to remove these plastics once they are in the environment or once they are in our bodies. And the only way to really control this problem is to reduce production at source. If we reduce the production of these nanoplastics and plastics, they will then not go into the environment and not go into our bodies. And that's the focus of this global meeting.
Can I ask you, Dr. Alam, here as a final comment, I guess what would make you more susceptible to ingesting these nanoplastics? And is there any way at this point that we can protect ourselves?
I think there are some ways that we can protect ourselves, right? So switching to metal bottles to carry water in instead of buying plastic bottles and all of that when you're going out and about. There are lots of water bottle refill stations around, so that's made it a lot more accessible. Other things like making sure you use metal pots, metal utensils, wooden pots, wooden utensils. The problem is, like Dr. Razak said, plastic is everywhere, like in everything from our clothing to our hair products. I agree with him. The only way we can start to tackle this problem is by targeting the sources of it. That's going to be really complicated because it isn't just about producing more plastic, right? That's ever present in our lives. It's about the people who produce them. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about changing jobs or taking away jobs from people. And this is, I think, where we're going to see a lot of resistance coming out. Plastic is so easy to use. That's why it's everywhere. And it's also a really good material to use because it's so durable and easy to use. It's accessible. However, it has consequences. And stopping the production of plastic is also going to have consequences. And this is going to be one of the difficult discussions we're going to have where do we make a change for a future that my generation won't really see the benefits of, but my kids will? Or do we continue focusing only on the now?
Those are good questions and a good way to wrap up our discussion today with the Medical Record panel. Doctors, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Jane.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jay.
Dr. Nadia Alam is a family doctor and anesthetist in Georgetown, Ontario, and past president of the Ontario Medical Association. Dr. Fahad Razak is Canada Research Chair in Data-Informed Healthcare Improvement at the University of Toronto. And Dr. Malcolm Moore is a medical oncologist at Princess Margaret Cancer Centre. It is Jane for Libby, and coming up in the second half of Fight Back, have you seen this campaign online? National Day of Theft, encouraging people to steal from Loblaws on May 12th as a way of combating greedflation by the grocery giant. We discuss next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
Libby is on vacation this week. She returns on Monday. Well, this article on Zoomer Media property Daily Hive got my attention, showing a poster outside a Loblaws store with the line, "The first annual Steal from Loblaws Day, May 12th, 2024. Is this how we fight back against greedflation? 416-360-0740, 1-866-744-740. There is a planned boycott of Loblaws that is expected to start on May 1st, and which emerged out of an online community called Loblaws is Out of Control. This seems to be a very different thing from this National Day of Theft. Sylvain Charlebois is the Senior Director of the Agri-Food Analytics Lab at Dalhousie University and joins us now to talk about these campaigns. Hello, Sylvain.
Good afternoon.
Is this National Day of Theft from Loblaws, is it a real thing?
I certainly hope not. I think what's happening is that some groups are getting organized to boycott certain grocers like Loblaws, but sometimes some of these movements, and frankly, people have every right to boycott a company if they want to, but sometimes these movements actually will attract, thugs and anarchists and people who basically just want to break the law. Mm. And that's kind of what's going on right now, because if you actually go on that Reddit page, I think they've erased most of it now, but some of the comments are absolutely unbelievable. It's all about anger and violence, and you just don't want that. So I'm not surprised to see some of these posters, and I'm just hoping that that it will stop, because it doesn't accomplish anything.
So the Loblaws is Out of Control boycott of Loblaws starting on May 1st. This National Day of Theft, from what you can tell, is an offshoot of that. Is that what's happened?
That is my belief, because I've actually been watching that group since November when it was created, and for a while you did see posts that would encourage people to steal and do all sorts of mischiefs, and I just didn't believe what I was reading, and they're very vile in terms of the language they use against people, including myself, by the way.
Yes, I heard you were a target.
No, it's absolutely, and the reason why I'm a target is because our university did accept a grant of $60,000 back in 2017, so my lab could fund a financially struggling international student so she can work on agriculture and agri-food policies. So, and because of that, of course, it's on our website, and because of that, I've been portrayed as someone who's on Loblaws payroll, which is obviously not the case.
Right. Does that grant of $60,000 make you feel indebted to Loblaws in any way?
No. It's the Weston Foundation, and over 400 scholars have actually received the same scholarship to support their research, but none of them is disclosing the amount because of what's going on with me.
Okay. Well, let's get to the phones here in just a moment. I knew this would be a hot topic. Sylvain, first of all, tell us, how prevalent is greedflation now that inflation has come down to an almost reasonable level? And arguably, we've also seen the grocery giants respond to our concerns about high prices and greedflation. And I personally am actually noticing a difference in seeing prices come down, or at least there are more sale prices more often.
Oh, absolutely. So even Statistics Canada would agree with you. The food inflation rate is down to 1.9%, still one of the lowest in the world. When you look at the greenflation argument, you have to look at gross margins, not profits. Companies should set record profits every year. That's how inflation works. So this argument about record profits is a false narrative. You have to look at gross margins, revenues minus the cost of goods. And when you look at Metro, Empire Sobeys, and Loblaws, all three of them, gross margins have actually remained basically the same the last 5 years. And these margins come from verified, audited financial reports. Again, Metro was reporting this morning, and the gross margin that came out of those documents are the same. The other thing that people need to know is food inflation and food sales. Food sales growth have actually remained underwater compared to food inflation. In other words, all of these grocers are actually making money selling other things than food. Mm. So in Loblaws' case, Shoppers Drug Mart is their bank. They actually make a lot of money with prescription drugs, cosmetics, perfumes, and things like that. So if you want to accuse Loblaws of gouging consumers selling Chanel No. 5, you may have a case, but not with sandwiches and flour.
Okay, 416-360-0740, 1-866-744-740. How have you, when inflation was much higher, how have you fought back as a consumer? Let's go to the phones now. Raymond in Etobicoke, what's your comment?
I would suggest a little change to their actions. Go into their grocery store, the Loblaws, if it's your regular one, doesn't matter. Go into the Loblaws, get a shopping cart, go around, put a bunch of stuff in it, come back and avoid the cashier, leave the cart in the store, walk out with nothing stolen. Let them see a bunch of shopping carts with food in it that might have been stolen.
Okay, and that's your way of making a point that I'm not buying this. I'm not actually following through with the purchase because everything is too expensive. That's in the cart.
Well, just to show that, that there is you could have stolen or tried to have stolen this, but that's not the right thing to do. But here's what I might have stolen.
Right. Yeah, no, I got you. Thank you, Raymond. Let's go to Dennis in Toronto. You're on the air, Dennis.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. My comment is I disagree with who you were talking with about gross margins. I mean, for 3 years, all the major grocers have had record profits with increasing food prices, blaming labor issues, transport issues, the cost of fuel. They've all been there before, not as bad as COVID, but for them to have record profits 3 years in a row. And here's just one other example of all the three major grocers. When there was the bread fiasco, there was no price fixing, and then they were proven to be wrong. And what was our payback? A single loaf of bread.
Well, it was $25 coupon, right?
What does that get you now? Five loaves?
Yeah. That's true. Dennis, thank you. I still have the same guest here with us, Sylvain Charlebois, so I will get him to respond to your comments. Thanks for calling.
Well, I mean, Loblaw has a really lousy track record when it comes to PR. And that's what we're hearing right now. The bread price fixing scandal, which lasted 14 years, cost probably Canadians about $1 billion. So we overpaid $1 billion for our bread for 14 years. Nobody went to jail. Nobody got a fine. So that's why I think, even though I disagree with the boycott, I do understand why there's a boycott and why perhaps some grocers would deserve a boycott, because it's been terrible. I mean, they've made a lot of decisions to anger Canadians, and a lot of Canadians just feel unprotected. So I agree. The cart strategy, I see where the person was getting to just leave the full cart there, but I certainly would have an issue if in that cart you have cold chain products like dairy products or meat products, because if you leave your cart there with food that needs to be refrigerated or frozen, they have to throw that food away, and you would waste food.
Right. So what is the best way to fight back if you've been upset about pricing at your grocery store? How do you change as a consumer so that you're winning?
Avoid big box stores. So first of all, if you are angry with Loblaws about higher food prices, you should be logically, you should be angry at all grocers, including Empire and Metro, because all of them, we've seen higher food prices. So if you're angry about food prices, go to independent grocers. There's tons of them in Toronto, tons, and they offer good deals. Avoid big box stores, go to the small shops. Small doesn't necessarily mean more expensive. That's what I would do.
Yeah. Good advice and a good place to end the conversation. Sylvain, thank you as always.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Sylvain Charlebois is the Senior Director of the Agri-Food Analytics Lab at Dalhousie University. I'm Jane for Libby, who returns on Monday. And are you a diehard Leafs fan, or are you just nostalgic for the time way back when the Leafs were Stanley Cup winners? Lines are open, 416-360-0740, 1-866-744-740. We talk with our sports expert, Wally Rigabon, next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
It is that time of year. The Toronto Maple Leafs have once again made it into the playoffs and are currently tied with the Boston Bruins at one game apiece in their first round series. Tonight they play game three in Toronto after splitting the first two games in Boston. Now, as you know, we are not a sports radio station. We leave that to other radio stations owned by the massive communications companies. But we do love nostalgia, and we would enjoy a run for the Stanley Cup after all these decades. Wally Rigabon is co-host of the Naz and Wally Sports Hour, heard Sundays at 9 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, and he joins us now. Hey, Wally.
Hey, Jane, how are you?
I'm great. It's nice to talk with you. It's been a while.
It has. It's great to talk to you, especially today.
Yeah.
We're 6 hours from game time, and we're starting to get pumped.
So what are your thoughts on the series so far?
I'm pleasantly surprised. You know, we haven't had William Nylander for two games, and I thought that would be a big hurdle to overcome, but you know, in game two, the Leafs played a much smarter game, stayed away from the mistakes that they made in game one. They got some solid goaltending. They got an all-world performance from an MVP candidate, Austin Matthews. So if we can continue in the direction we've established, is certainly certainly from the result from game two. You know what? We could get a positive result out of this series. I'm hopeful and optimistic.
You know, looking into the future, well into the future, Austin Matthews may one day be referred to as an iconic hockey player. After all, he got his 69 goals. How vital is he to this team and the opportunity they have to win a Stanley Cup?
You know what? Good friend of the Naz and Wally Sports Hour, Harry Neal, always reminds us when we get him on the show, is your best players have to be your best players. And Austin Matthews, we talked about it on the show last Sunday. As far as I'm concerned, he's the most valuable player and should win the Hart Trophy this year. So the Leafs can't win this series without Austin Matthews playing at an MVP caliber. And the thing about Austin, it's not about the, just the 69 goals, Jane. He's actually a candidate for the Frank Selke Award, which is the best defensive player in the league. So he's your guy. He's your go-to guy. He's the guy that you strap the team to. He's the guy who's going to take us to the next level in game two. If he keeps that kind of performance going, we can beat the hated Bruins.
I want to ask you about the history of the Toronto Maple Leafs here in just a moment. But first, let's go to Wendy in Guelph. Yeah. Wendy, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, hello, Jane. I hope your day is going well. Happy birthday to Sam. I didn't get that through this morning. And I just wanted to say it is hard to be a Leafs fan, but I have always been one. Born in 62. So I was three or four years old on my father's shoulders with my grandmother in downtown Toronto when they had the parade of the last time that they won.
I love this story. That's a great story.
Yes, and it's, anyway, I'm just happy to talk to you, my dear, and get my comment, and go Leafs go, because it's hard to be a Leaf fan, but damn it, I am.
Okay, Wendy, thanks for calling, and I'll pass along your message to Sam as well. There are a lot of people in that age group, you and me among them, Wally, who would love, who remember the those days and would love to have them repeated now.
I certainly do. It would be... you know, the first thing we'd like to do is we don't want to get ahead of ourselves. We got to get past the hated Bruins. But if this Leaf team goes on a lengthy playoff run, the excitement it would generate in this city would be off the charts.
It would.
And you see it outside in Maple Leaf Square. And this is, you know, the part of it I really, really like. Let me turn that off.
See, everybody needs you, Wally.
Let me turn that off.
Okay.
What I love to see is those young people out in Maple Leaf Square, and there's, you know, I don't know how many, 1,000, 2,000, and they are incredibly passionate. And I made the comment on the show on Sunday, man, it would be great if we could put them inside the Scotiabank Arena to get their energy and their enthusiasm in the rink. The young people certainly, you see it at Maple Leaf Square every time there's a Leafs game, and, the energy that's going on in the city right now. Yeah. And if we keep this thing going, wow, how exciting is that going to be?
Well, we all remember pre-pandemic, not that long before the pandemic in 2019, when the Raptors energized this city. I mean, how special is that for Toronto as a city? One day at a time, but if we were to capture that same kind of feeling.
There are so many of us, Jane. You know, I'm old enough to remember. I can remember the 63 Cup. I can't remember the 62 Cup. I remember the 63 Cup. I remember the 64 Cup. I have vivid memories of the 67 Cup. There are so many of our generation that, you know, the Leafs to win the Stanley Cup is on our bucket list. And I joke about it on the show. People ask me, how long are you going to be doing this Naz and Wally Sports Hour? I said, I'm going to keep doing it until the Leafs win the Stanley Cup. and we joke about that, and it could be a long time. But there are so many of us that, you know, if the Leafs ever won the Stanley Cup, and we talked about it with Joe Bowen a couple of weeks ago, that I'd love to hear him call the Leafs winning. It's just, it would be the highlight of a lifetime for so many of us. It's been so long.
416.
The passion is off the charts.
Right. 416-360-0741-866-744-740. Tony in Mississauga, you're on the air with Wally Rigabon and Jane Brown. Go ahead.
Good morning. Yes, I was just saying to your screener that I'm a masochist. I hurt so good, but I'm still going to die as a Leaf fan.
Yeah. It's a special breed, right?
We take punishment every spring, and you know, every time the Leafs, you know, the last, you know, it's been a long time since we've had any success. And you know what, the cliche is hope springs eternal.
Well, we all know that the last time the Leafs won the Stanley Cup, 1967. But just give us a thumbnail sketch of what's been going on since 1967, because there have been other runs in previous decades.
Well, we had some good runs in the late 70s when Daryl Sittler and Lanny McDonald were the key parts of the team, with Boreas Salming and that generation. They were exciting. Great victory over the New York Islanders. Unfortunately, they ran up against a legendary team, the Montreal Canadiens of the late 70s. So that sort of stood in their way. We had the exciting run in 1993, I think it was, with Dougie Gilmore and Wendell Clark. And unfortunately, that was the infamous Carey Fraser episode in Game 6, where Gretzky high-sticked, I can't remember if it was Wendell or Dougie, and should have got a penalty. And that was the year we would have won the cup. We would have faced Montreal, and we had been successful against Montreal all season long. So after 93, I got to admit, Jane, it's been dry. It's been pretty dry. A couple of runs in the early 2000s with some of those teams. But it's been a long, dry spell, and, so many heartbreaks, so many, these hated Boston Bruins.
So tell us quickly about the history between the Boston Bruins and the Maple Leafs and why they're so hated.
We haven't beat the Boston Bruins in a playoff series since 1959, Jane.
Yeah.
In the early 70s, I think it was 69 or whatever, it was infamous Bobby Orr, Pat Quinn episode. They bounced us 10-0. They bounced us 8-0. The last 10 years, it's been horrible. We 4-1 lead in Game 7, losing Game 7 a couple of times. It's just, it would warm my heart if we got past these Bruins.
Well, eventually the curse has to lift, right?
Well, we hope it's this year. we certainly hope. I'm actually heading down to the game tonight. I'm going to be screaming up a storm. I hope the rest of the fans are into it, and it's going to be tough. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. The Bruins aren't going to go away easily, and the Leafs are up against it, but Let's cheer them on as best as we can, and let's see if we can get over this hurdle.
You know, when you walk around Scotiabank Arena, I go occasionally to watch whatever game, usually the Raptors, once a year the Leafs. But, you see all those old black and white photos on the walls, and the history around this team, I mean, it really is something.
I always take the opportunity. I go down as a fan. I mean, I'm a fan of the Toronto Maple Leafs. I don't pretend to be anything other on the show. We are fans, and I'm proudly going to be wearing my number 14 David Keon sweater tonight.
Nice.
He was there. He was the last time the Leafs won the cup. He's the Conn Smythe Trophy winner in 1967. He's a frequent contributor to our show. And I'm hoping being down there wearing David Keon might bring us a little bit of good luck.
I hope it does, too. Wally, it was great chatting with you. And I hope when you're on the air next on Sunday morning, the Leafs are up a couple more games.
Well, I certainly hope so. I've said it the last few times. On Sunday mornings, we always have to deal with what happened on Saturday nights. And Naz and I are always in better spirits if the Leafs win on a Saturday night rather than if they lose. So we're certainly hoping this Sunday show that we're going to be doing it and the Leafs are going to be in the lead in the series. So,
okay, Wally, thank
got
you.
Got my fingers crossed, Jane.
Yep, and if this thing keeps on going, we'll be chatting with you again on Fight Back Down the Road.
It's going to be wild, believe me.
Okay, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Jane. It's always a privilege and a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Wally Rigabon is co-host of the Naz and Wally Sports Hour, heard every Sunday, 9 a.m. here on Zoomer Radio. Jane for Libby, and tomorrow the Tune Into the Town panel joins me. Right now, the news with Bob Komsic, and then the number ones at 1.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to 1. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.